Please be seated. Good afternoon, everybody. This is case number 53159, Norman Flowers versus State of Nevada. And this is the northern panel of the Supreme Court of Nevada. And because of the suggestion of my colleague over here on the left, Justice Gibbons, we decided that when we had overflow Clark County cases that we'd come down here to save you trips and money and grief and all that other stuff.
Justice Chair, I thought Ms. Lucich went back to Carson City.
Well, she comes up once in a while. So we save the state public defender, the special public defender, and the DA's office the time, so you just be able to come over here and then do your argument and then go back to the office and not have to fly back and forth. So it's our pleasure to do this for our attorneys and our parties in Clark County, Nevada. Mr. Pike, are you ready on this case?
I am, Your Honor.
And would you like to save some time on it, to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes as a goal, but not an expectation.
Go ahead.
Mr. Pike, can I ask you one question? I know there's a lot of issues here. One that kind of, I think, we're the three of us are concerned about. On the DNA testimony about the hearsay issue, you know, did the trial counsel object to that as being hearsay when that testimony was elicited?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would either direct that now or later on.
Well, whatever you want. We just had a concern about that.
Well, since that
actually, be clear on any issues that you raise as to whether there's been an objection or not an objection, because that, if we're talking about harmless error versus plain error, and that's very important to this court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And so, with the question directed by Justice Gibbons, welcome. Thank you for welcoming me to argue this today. Randall Pike from the Special Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Flowers. And the DNA evidence, you'll note that it was the defense that brought forward the motion in limine to prohibit the introduction of other bad acts as opposed to the state introducing the motion to bring it in. So we anticipated, objected to it, and knew that we were going to have to fight it. And during the time of the Petrocelli hearing, there was a testimony, and that's in the second volume of the appendix on page 270, that the DNA expert that was going to be testifying at the time of trial and did testify at the time of the trial was DNA expert Paulette. Wahl, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, W-H-L, or W-A-H-L, performed the test initially. At the time of the Petrocelli hearing, it was learned that his DNA had somehow commingled on the Gonzalez case, which was a third matter. Judge Bell excluded that. He allowed the state to bring in, with specific restrictions, the Coot case. I'll just call it by that name. In the Coot case, Judge Bell said that you can put on that case to show intent, to show identity, and bring in the similarities in vaginal tearing, the DNA profile person. And that's as far as the state can go, along with the detective and the nurse testifying. When it came time for trial, Paulette, the testifying DNA person, started to testify, and at the time that she began to testify, she was asked this question by the state. And in terms of Merrily Coot's vaginal swabs, what were Mr. Wall's findings? There was a contemporaneous objection to that was found in the third volume on page 551. That was made by me. I proceeded through some voir dire questions in relationship to that, and she established the fact, well, yes, I was capable of serving as a custodian of records, and I'm bringing in those records. So that, and along with the fact that Judge Bell had allowed a continuing objection to the introduction of the other bad act, were specific contemporaneous objections to take that Crawford Melendez-Diaz violation outside of plain error and not subject it to the harmless error standard.
So the judge said that you objected as being hearsay, and the judge says there's an exception under the business record provision of Chapter 51, and that was his ruling?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And then in going through that, there was the DNA expert never said that she went back in and re-examined the vaginal swabs that were done in this case. That's important because she did do some additional testing, but she only tested the carpet. She did not retest the vaginal swabs of the Coot case. And so that portion of the testimony that came in was violative of Melendez-Diaz. And I think that if you take the Polk case that has since been decided by this court, along with the Vega case, it takes it... in Melendez-Diaz, the laboratory assistant's affidavits were found violative. In Polk, your honors found that the medical records were determined to be testimonial. And in Vega, firearms examination were also found to be testimonial. So certainly DNA testimony should be considered testimonial. And as it was presented in this case, it was just done merely as a conduit. She did not do any addition. The DNA expert Paulette did not do any additional testing in relationship to the vaginal swabs, which were the important nexus between the location of the DNA between the other, this other bad act, the Coot case, and the Quarles case in which Mr. Flowers was being tried. Because specifically in the Quarles case for which he was tried, the only place where his DNA was located was within the vagina of the deceased. That along with the DNA of another person, Mr. Brass, who subsequent to this trial was convicted of murder on his own case.
Who was he convicted of? Is that anything to do with this case, the murder of Mr. Brass?
No, he was just pending trial in that when he came before and testified that he had a sexual relationship with Miss Quarles, although nobody knew about it in the family and he didn't come forward or anything else.
Mr. Pike, I anticipate the state will argue, as consistent with the briefs, that if there was error on the hearsay issue on Miss Coot, that it's harmless as to Miss Quarles, you know, like that, the conviction. What's your response to that?
It's hard to foresee any circumstances where someone who is coming up for a trial can be accused of being identified with a murder, not being convicted, but being, in the minds of the detective, already convicted. This is not harmless because when Judge Bell improperly allowed this to come in, it opened up a cascading effect of what the testimony was going to be. Detective Tremel, I believe, came in, and when he was testifying about, well, how he found this other case, he says that he looked at the Coot homicide notebook and found that there was another victim who had been, and this is his quote, strangled and violently sexual assaulted by Flowers. So his testimony coming in as the predecessor to bring in this other event indicated that, oh, this was a proven matter. It already proved it was violent, just like it, and everything else. That was found on page 523 of the third volume. And that did not give the impression that the Coot case was still pending. He hadn't been convicted. There was not that testimony that came in. Additionally, because of the cascading effect that I've indicated, when the police came in to interrogate Mr. Flowers, he was currently in custody and he was pending trial on the Coot case. The state had already filed its notice of intent to seek the death penalty. While in other cases it has been held that...
In the Coot case, right.
And in fact, he still hasn't been tried on the Coot case. We're going to go to trial on that in June of this year. That interrogation, I'll concede that there have been cases that said it's permissible for detectives to come in and interview detainees if they're not talking to them about that case. In this case, there was a confluence of facts involving the fact that any other homicide is going to serve as an aggravator. Any other bad act that they're going to interrogate him about, with based upon the technical way in which the aggravators are found, the weighing equation that the parties have involving whether or not to impose death, When someone is sitting in custody pending a trial for an execution, that rule should be different. And I'd like to say that we found some authority, but Mrs. Thomas and I were unable to do that. So this is these specific facts, case-specific facts, are unusual. I'll stand up and wrap myself in the Constitution and argue that death is different. That in fundamental fairness, when you're going to take someone who may be executed because of what you're interrogating them about, it is so intricately tied to the case that you cannot separate it apart as a separate error.
What rule would you ask for, though? Because they still have to advise the person on Miranda rights.
They have to advise them of the Miranda rights, but because they are in custody and represented by counsel, then in the event of this case, it would be simply a matter of saying that, and because you are pending or have a death penalty pending before you, this may affect your trial. Or even if it's not a death penalty, they say, what you tell us may affect this current case that you have. And indeed, although he was warned of his Miranda rights, and he started to talk with detectives, then he had second thoughts about it and said, well, I'd like to talk to my attorneys. By that time, detectives had initiated enough of a conversation that Judge Bell allowed testimony concerning a part of that conversation that even though he allowed the detectives to come in and testify that he was evasive, that somehow he was not being forthright with the detectives or what's being involved in the case. And then trying to make that not seem quite so bad, there was a strategic decision made on part of me, trial counsel, to bring in the entire matter to say, well, he had a right to an attorney because, of course, Judge Bell was commenting upon the fact that, well, he had a right to remain silent, and he invoked it, and he said that in front of the jury. Didn't let me get into the fact that he had a chance to talk to him. He wanted to talk to an attorney, and then he talked to them. Which is a statutory error, along with the constitutional errors that have preceded this. So I couldn't bring in the full statement, couldn't develop the full story, couldn't articulate why he was not being cooperative. And then those arguments infected the arguments in the case. Now you can see that this was a collegially hard-fought trial between the parties.
Right.
We went toe-to-toe, but in a very, professional manner.
Mr. Pike, on the statement about that the party went to testify that Ms. Quarles was seeing somebody named Keith, why wouldn't that be hearsay? Because I don't know about this 51.355, I don't quite follow that exception there. And if you're using the due process argument, that we have a recent opinion, Justice Pickering authored State versus John Fields, didn't that discuss the issue, the due process issue there in that context?
Well, it did. The reason that it was not, well, it was hearsay, obviously, because it was a third party, but not offered for the truth of the matter. Certainly, it could have offered into her state of mind. Was she afraid of anybody? Was she afraid of Mr. Flowers? Hearsay can be offered for that, to show that there is not a fear of that. The state had brought in evidence that she didn't like older men, that she may have been afraid of older men based upon an older gentleman that had come to the house and tried to contact her before, and that so that was offered, it could have been offered to explain that, well, yeah, maybe she was interested in that, and she was not afraid of Keith. She did not do that, indicate that. And along with that was the issue about whether or not the state had admitted hearsay arguments in reference to Brass. Well, did Brass ever come forward? He didn't come forward until years after that. And there were other ways to take that information and bring it in for non-hearsay purposes, not the truth of the matter. It's generally reliable because of the relationship that she had with Mr. Kinsey, the witness that we called. She wrote her name as being married to him on the letter that was waiting on her bed to be mailed to him in prison. She called herself Sheila Kinsey. So this is an individual that knew her intimately, and his testimony was would have been offered to rebut that, and not necessarily just for the truth of the matter asserted in that statement.
Why wouldn't it be harmless if we did find it to be error? Why isn't it harmless?
Well, because the reason that when you take the cumulative errors that are involved in the case, you've got the introduction of another murder, you've got the state in expanding on the arguments, making arguments to the jury where they artfully beg the comparison between the person that came in to tell you the truth, Mr. Brass, who had nothing to gain, who cooperated with the police, and that was just begging the comparison to the silent Mr. Flowers. There he sits. He's uncooperative, evasive, and then during rebuttal, there was another skillful argument. Why is he so evasive? And drawing that comparison between the two of the parties, you extend into due process violations where ultimately it begs the jury to say, why is he invoking those rights? And the jury would necessarily and naturally feel that somehow something had to have been done, and that somehow when that evidence came in, there should be something to rebut it. Well, did they? If you're saying why this, we had this, but there wasn't anything over there, then it almost begs a due process shift of the burden of proof to come in and say, why wasn't this presented? Where was it? Without saying it in so many words, but artfully implying it, then it burdenly exercises the right to remain silent to an intolerable degree. There's constitutional violations, statutory violations, there's hearsay violations, and the introduction of other bad act evidence that's based upon the DNA identification of the DNA in the vagina. You can't, circumstantially there may be some evidence in relationship to the carpet, but it's so intimately involved from the vagina that the Melendez-Diaz violations while introduced in the other bad act, and the state exceeding the limited ruling in the other bad act, caused a case in which it cannot be considered to be harmless error. It's overwhelmingly infected and caused this trial to be necessarily to be reversed and remanded.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. Ms. Berkowitz, on behalf of the state.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Pamela Weckerly, and I represent the state of Nevada. Ms. Lusage and I were trial counsel, as well as Mr. Pike, in this proceeding. On March the 23rd of 2005, Deborah Quarles arrived home to find her 18-year-old daughter submerged in a bathtub of hot water. The time frame on the investigation of the murder, because of various cell phone calls between the victim and some friends, as well as her mother, made the time frame of the murder a very short time. We had it narrowed down in this case to about an hour and a half, where the murder had to have occurred before Deborah Quarles arrived home and found her daughter. Autopsy revealed that the victim, Sheila Quarles, had been strangled, but she ultimately died of drowning, and it also revealed that she had been sexually assaulted. This case would likely have gone unsolved, but for the fact that Mr. Flowers, less than 2 months later, committed two more homicides on May the 3rd of 2005, at another apartment complex in Las Vegas. The victims in those cases were Marilee Coote, as you've read about in the briefing in this case, as well as a young woman by the name of Rena Gonzalez. There was actually a third woman that he had contact with on the May date that he had some interactions with that were quite peculiar, which sort of brings me to the first issue that was before this court, or that was briefed before this court, which was the admissibility of that subsequent incident in our case in chief. Judge Bell gave us a limited ruling on the May events in terms of what we were allowed to admit in our trial regarding the March incident. And we were limited to only information about Marilee Coop and the facts surrounding her murder. We were precluded from bringing any of the interactions, which were quite strange, between the defendant and a woman by the name of Juanita Curry on the May date, and we were also precluded from bringing in information regarding the Rena Gonzalez murder. With that limited ruling, as the court, I'm sure, has reviewed the record, every single witness who testified regarding the Marilee Coot case, there was an admonishment given by the court every single time any evidence was elicited by the state regarding that incident. The basis of admissibility for the other bad acts evidence in this case was intent and identity. And Judge Bell's ruling was that this was a case where there were substantial similarities between the two incidents. Both Marilee Coot and Sheila Quarles were African-American women. Both were found nude in their residences face up. A condom was not used in either event. Both had minor property taken in association with the sexual assault in the murder. No weapon was used in either event. Both crime scenes involved sort of staged events and attempt to destroy evidence by means of water in the two separate incidences. And both had sort of an attenuated sort of acquaintance relationship with Norman Flowers, and both, of course, involved strangulation as the means of death and sexual assault. So certainly the state was not seeking to admit this evidence to suggest that Norman Flowers is a violent individual, or he is a criminal, or he is a sex offender. The evidence was specifically admitted to show his intent and his identity. And as I previously discussed, there was an admonishment given the proper use of this evidence throughout the trial. At the beginning of the trial, in opening statements, and this is in the second volume at page 347, defense counsel opened with the suggestion that the contact between Norman Flowers and our victim, Sheila Quarles, was consensual, that this was a consensual sexual encounter. Once the defense opened with that suggestion to the jury, certainly the state had an even greater basis to seek to admit the subsequent incident where Mr. Flowers had contact with another woman who ended up, oddly enough, sexually assaulted and strangled, murdered as well. Throughout the presentation of the evidence, the state was careful to limit what evidence was presented as a result of the bad act ruling. There's some suggestion, or actually there is a suggestion in the brief, that he somehow went beyond the ruling of Judge Bell. Of course, the court can review the record. There was no objection of that nature at all by the defense during the trial. And as this court has learned this afternoon, we did not have a conviction in the Coot case, so we had to make sure we established it by clear and convincing evidence in order for the jury to justifiably consider it in the presentation of our case. And once again, the testimony of several witnesses, including DNA analyst Paulette, Detective Trimmel, who investigated the double homicide, and Juanita Curry, was limited to only discuss the Coop case. So it's the state's position, obviously, that that was the correct ruling. If there are no questions on that issue, I'd like to move on to the Melendez-Diaz issue.
Please.
My interpretation of the record, which I'll discuss a little bit later on, is that there was no objection regarding Dr. Sims's testimony, so at a very minimum, that should be analyzed under the plain error standard instead of the harmless error standard, as this court has ruled in the Vega case. With regard to analyst Paulette, I'll discuss that a little bit later under which standard I think is appropriate. With regard to this issue, certainly what we did in this trial is quite distinguishable from what happened in Melendez-Diaz, where an affidavit was prepared for court in lieu of testimony. This was quite different than that. Dr. Sims and Christina Paulette were the expert witnesses subject to cross and had reviewed the prior reports of other analysts or other scientists in their field. My review of the cases issued by this court is that this court hasn't directly ruled in terms of Melendez-Diaz on autopsy reports or DNA reports. The Polk case, I know, discussed firearms admissibility and expert testimony regarding that, but because of the briefing that was done by the state in that case, I don't think the court reached the exact issue. In the Vega case, which came out in 2010, this court ruled, or my interpretation is this court ruled, that it was okay for a doctor to review the sexual assault nurse's reports and then offer her own interpretation or her own testimony regarding those issues, even though she hadn't done the underlying examination, that was permissible expert testimony. However, the court also ruled that to the extent that the doctor reiterated what was said in the nurse examiner's report, that was hearsay, but then it subjected it to actually a plain error analysis in that case because there was no objection. Other jurisdictions have sort of viewed this differently. This court may opt to draw a distinction between scientific data like DNA analysis, which is almost a contemporaneous recording of scientific results, which is slightly different than what occurred in the Vega case, which is an interaction between a sexual assault victim and a nurse examiner, which might be more subject to a more testimonial type analogy. The autopsy report, of course, is scientific as well, but this court hasn't, to my knowledge, reached that issue. Some courts, the Greer Court in California and the Illinois Supreme Court, have found that an expert who didn't do the original examination not only can testify as an expert witness in terms of offering expert testimony like an autopsy report or like a DNA report, but they also can testify regarding the underlying report or testing that wasn't done by them, because that forms the basis of their expert opinion.
Well, it makes sense because having done a lot of homicide cases myself, they drag on a little longer than most cases, and nobody says that the coroner has to be, or the medical examiner has to remain under the employ of the county or state or whoever they work for. So it makes sense. But DNA would be different. You could retest the DNA. What about that?
You can retest the DNA, but some of the DNA testing in terms of developing a buccal swab standard for a suspect or testing extract, there's two issues with that. One, we want to preserve sample in order for the defense to retest if they want to. And secondly, if there's nothing wrong with the original testing, there is really no different result that could be reached given how the DNA testing is done. If there's a problem with contamination, I could see where that would be an issue. But so much of DNA testing is subjected to very rigorous scientific standards that I don't know that it would be qualitatively different regarding the results.
But in both situations, there were actual live witnesses who came forth both on cause of death and on DNA that could be cross-examined by a defense attorney.
Absolutely, absolutely. And certainly, as you know, in the cases, a lot of times we get cold DNA cases that involve homicides, and unfortunately the pathologist has died. So, I mean, we may be in a situation where we would be precluded from prosecuting unless another doctor could testify. I mean, that's a pretty unfavorable result, I think, to preclude that type of testimony.
Well, it's not fair to a victim's family that may want to do cremation rather than burial. And
absolutely.
Even though they dig up the body a lot in Law and Order, it's not really
not
realistic.
Quite like that, no.
I have a question, though, on Mr. Pike is saying that he did make the objection. In the state's brief on page 18, lines 24 through 26, said that there was no objection, and I'd like clarification of that.
My read of the brief, and I'm looking at the third volume at page 552, was initially there was a hearsay objection raised. Then Mr. Pike asked some additional questions, which established Ms. Paulette as a custodian of records, and then there was no further objection, and the direct examination continued after that. The other thing I would just like to point out with regard to Ms. Paulette's testimony is she specifically retested the carpet sample in the Merrilee Coote case, and this is in the third volume again at page 553. And the reason why that was so significant in this case is that the victim, Merrilee Coote, was found laying in her living room nude, and the piece of carpet underneath her vaginal area was what was tested. And whose DNA was on that? Norman Flowers. So it was obvious that that had leaked out of her body. And that was specifically retested by analyst Paulette, which would, to me, satisfy any harmless error analysis. While it's true that she did not retest the vaginal and rectal swabs, at that same volume in the record at page 553 to 558, she does testify to her interpretation of those findings, which I think further bolsters a harmless error analysis.
Excuse me, Ms. Wicker, this carpet was right underneath the victim?
Absolutely.
Right position, maybe, where it would have leaked from her genital area?
Absolutely, yes. That's why it was such a significant piece of evidence. Okay. So based on that, I would say that's harmless error, and at best, or it satisfies the harmless error standard. And also, I'd just like to point out that analyst Paulette was the DNA examiner in the case that we were there for, the Quirrell's case, which adds some or lends some argument to our position that it was at best a harmless error that occurred to the extent she testified regarding the vaginal and rectal swabs that were tested.
Was the testimony presented in the form of an expert who is rendering opinion based perhaps in part on hearsay? And if so, was there an objection to that kind of a presentation?
My read of the record is there was no objection of that nature. And I would also point out that the defense called a DNA expert in this case as well, who relied on Wall's testing, Paulette's testing, and actually agreed with all of that testing and just presented the numerical data differently. And that's that same third volume at page 361. So certainly...
So both experts are relying on this?
Absolutely. And that lends further credibility to our position that this is absolutely harmless error. With regard to, if I may move on, with regard to Dr. Sims's testimony, there is a mountain of references to his own interpretation. What he did is he reviewed the underlying autopsy reports, and he also looked at the photographic evidence that was taken at the time of autopsy for both victims. And he testified to seeing for himself in those photographs tears to the vaginal area of Sheila Quirrell's, the fact that there was no swelling, which lended support to his position that the sexual assault and the murder were contemporaneous. I think the combination, if the court reviews both of those experts' testimony, it's quite clear that each of these experts formed an independent opinion. And even if this court were to apply the more strict harmless error analysis rather than the plain error analysis, we would still satisfy that given the independent opinions that were expressed by both experts in terms of the cause of death and the DNA evidence in this case.
Let me give you another 2 minutes, and then I'm going to give Mr. Pike 3 minutes in rebuttal. So take another 2 minutes, Ms. Wicker.
Okay. The last thing I would just like to address is Mr. Pike's statements about the statement that his client made to Detective Sherwood. And just briefly, that statement was a Mirandi statement. That was in the record in the first volume at page 228. Mr. Pike suggests that there should be some change in the law given that he was facing a capital or a potentially capital case in the Merrill Lee Coote case. But you have to remember at the time that Detective Sherwood interviewed Norman Flowers, I mean, he's the detective on a completely different case, and I don't think we need to charge detectives with what the DA may be filing in a case that's completely separate. And there's no case law, constitutional, federal case law, or even state case law that suggests that there would be any sort of requirement that they do an extra waiver with regard to the fact that they may be facing a capital sentence in a different case. And the other thing I would point out is by operation of Rule 250, we weren't we weren't even allowed to file the Coot case, the case we're here on, as an aggravating circumstance, or the Quarles case, as an aggravating circumstance in the Coot case until we got a conviction. We had to file a motion after we got a conviction in the Quarles case in front of the Coot judge to use this as an aggravating circumstance. It wouldn't have existed as an aggravating circumstance at the time that Detective Sherwood did his interview of Norman Flowers. But the bottom line is adding that layer of complication, I don't think has any effect on a voluntariness of a waiver or an informed waiver. It just has no place in that type of interaction.
Thank you, Ms. Wickerly.
Thank you.
Mr. Pike, 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. To begin with, there was nothing in the record to show that Mr. Wall was not available. There was nothing to indicate that he no longer worked for the police department. There was nothing to indicate that he was unable to testify for any reason whatsoever. There was evidence to indicate that his testing protocols were at question because in the Petrocelli hearing, which is before Your Honors, his DNA was found to overlay the Gonzalez case and was kicked, and it was eliminated, or it was excluded, rather, by Judge Bell in that case. So without showing that he was unavailable, showing that his protocols were at issue, and then dealing with the fact that, as Your Honor indicated, well, can we, that piece of carpet, was it under the body? Was that where it happened? That's not in the trial. That could be an interpretation. It's nothing, it's not proven. There's no citation to that. The state, in responding to the question, did not say that's where it came from. And it was not introduced as that. So to draw that.
You said that's not in the record.
It's not in the record. I was trying to find it during the arguments there. I could not locate
it. How was it presented then?
It was presented just through the presentation that DNA expert Paulette said, well, I tested this carpet. They didn't bring in a piece of the carpet as a piece of evidence. The detective did not.
This was during the trial in front of the jury.
During the trial. Right.
So Paulette said in front of the jury that I tested carpet underneath Ms. Coot's body and it had Mr. Flowers' DNA.
I tested carpet.
Carpet.
Not where the carpet was located. She was not present when it was collected. Did not testify.
So she said a piece of carpet. There was no evidence as to where the carpet came from.
That's correct. It was part of the Coot case, which was also important in this case because the carpet in the Quarles case was never examined with any sort of even ultraviolet light to determine whether there were any carpet stains, whether there was anything other DNA besides that. We're only dealing with that DNA. And finally, in determining whether or not this is, with the cumulative errors in this case, is this a case where the verdict would not have been the same without this? Well, the jury found that this was not an intentional murder. We had a specific verdict form. They said they found that it was just part of their finding on a sexual assault. He was charged with a robbery for stealing items inside of the apartment. We presented evidence of a witness that saw a Mr. Nava, I believe N-A-V-A, who, after the murder, was found in possession of the items that were stolen from the apartment during the time that this occurred and admitted to stealing them from that apartment to the witness that we proffered and that we had testify during the time of the trial. That Brass, his alibi, he withheld his existence for years. His alibi was in question because he was questioned by police on that day. It wasn't recorded. He didn't check out. And they relied upon his checking in and out of work in order to verify his alibi. But he testified he didn't do that. So in reference to those items and with being out of time, thank you very much.
Thank you. Justice Gibbons would like Ms. Wickerly to talk about that carpet for just a brief second. Just we're confused. And clear up our confusion as to what you recollect.
The testimony on the location of the carpet would have come in through crime scene analysts who are in the record, Smink, Jeff Smink, and Charity Green, because they were the ones that actually cut out the piece of carpet in Merrilee Coot's case. Christina Paulette just gets the item of evidence. So it's true, she doesn't know where it came from. Detective Tremel probably also testified to the location of that piece of carpet as being under the victim. But it's true, the DNA analyst doesn't know because she didn't go to the apartment, but that was that foundation was laid through other witnesses.
Thank you, Ms. Weckerly. Thanks to both Mr. Pike and Ms. Weckerly. I expected good argument, and you lived up to my expectations. This case will stand submitted, and thank you very much to all of you. Good seeing you all.